This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit theuavdigest.com/goengineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. You're listening to episode 176 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Good evening, Max. How are we?
Hi, David. Doing well. We're coming up on the end of the year. Things are busy. I think this is going to be our last episode for this year, 2016.
Yeah, well, we're going to take a week off, folks. We're sorry, but you know, I'm flying to Canada and Max is going to just not want to have earbuds in his ears for 1 week. So I think we owe him that. So I guess we should get started on our last episode of the year. A drone gets a ho-ho-ho hydrogen fuel cell. Patent technology that protects drones. Looking beyond humans for beyond visual line of sight. Now, Santa is because of beyond visual line of sight. We have to work on that. And do you believe the next one, Max? I can't. When you wrote this in the show notes, I couldn't believe it. But the FAA marks 1 year anniversary of United States drone registration.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that that was a whole 12 months ago.
I mean, you know before you fly. Mm. And we got lots of videos of the week because we don't want to work. We're being lazy. It's that time of the year. So I guess with that, we should get started. All right. Well, our first story, NRL completes the first flight of a UAV with a custom hydrogen fuel cell. Merry Christmas, Max. This is your story. You like these hydrogen fuel cells.
Yeah, I do kind of have a fascination for them. So this is a team from the U.S. Naval Research Laboratory, or the NRL, and they have a drone that they've actually flown for a number of years, the Ion Tiger, but they have just flown it with a new fuel cell that they have designed. Now, it's a fixed-wing drone. It's a pretty good-sized aircraft. This new hydrogen fuel cell, you know, I'm a little confused, David, because the article we have, as well as some indications on the NRL website, say that this fuel cell generates 5,000 watts, which is a lot. But there's also a page on the NRL that says 550 watts, which is the equivalent of about 3/4 of a horsepower. So I'm not sure what the power rating of this is. Maybe they flew it at 550, and it's conceivable that it could generate as much as 5,000. But in any event, they use some new technology. They use these metal foil bipolar plates, which allowed them to save some space and weight. We really see these fuel cells coming up more and more often. And I think, David, they kind of represent a key technology when it comes to long endurance drones that, you know, don't require frequent battery replacements.
Batteries, batteries, batteries. If there's one thing that's lurking in the underneath all of this as the ultimate limitation, it's batteries, you know, and fuel cells are going to probably be what replaces batteries, you know. We don't want things blowing up and exploding, you know. Our battery technology is kind of weak. The more endurance, and I think for all intents and purposes, fuel cells are lighter also, and they're a little bit more environmentally healthy. So all the roads lead that this is the technology we need. We just want to know, we don't know how long it's going to take to perfect it.
Usually the only byproduct of a fuel cell is water. So it might be worth it just to take a few minutes to talk about how fuel cells work, since we seem to be talking about them so often. There are lots of different kinds of fuel cells. Most of them are powered with hydrogen. And really, they're very simple in design. You have an anode, an electrolyte, and a cathode. So what happens is the fuel, usually hydrogen, comes in and first strikes the anode, which is a material that in the presence of hydrogen, a reaction is formed. And what happens is that hydrogen protons pass through the electrolyte headed for the cathode. But the electrons that result from this reaction can't do that. And so what you do is you have basically a wire connected to the anode, routed over to the other side, the cathode, and the electrons flow through that wire. Well, what are electrons flowing through a wire? That's electricity. That's where the power comes from. So you have the hydrogen protons meeting the cathode on the other side of this little sandwich, if you will. They meet up with the electrons coming in from that wire, and you have yet another reaction. That takes place with the air that's coming in, striking the cathode. The air has oxygen. So if you've got hydrogen, electrons, and oxygen, what does that put together and become? Well, H2O, water. There's your output. So it's pretty simple. It's difficult to pull off in practice in some cases. And again, I think we're going to see more and more of this, more and more of this coming on. But this Ion Tiger has got some history to it. Way back in November 2009, it actually flew for 26 hours. At the same time, it was carrying a 5-pound payload. And in that case, they used hydrogen as the fuel compressed in a 5,000 PSI pressure vessel. And then later on in 2013, in May, the Ion Tiger, that flew for 48 hours, actually 48 hours and 1 minute. And in that case, they used liquid hydrogen as the fuel in a cryogenic fuel tank. So the NRL has done a lot of interesting work with this fuel cell and with developments of the fuel cell. There's a quote in here from the program manager at the Office of Naval Research, and they said, or he said, the NRL having the know-how to build their own fuel cells in-house gives ONR, Office of Naval Research, and the U.S. Navy the understanding and tools needed to transition fuel cells to the fleet. If you can make these things small enough, light enough, it sounds like a really great way to power a drone.
And in case you're falling asleep because of that, there is a lovely diagram in the show notes that actually makes perfect sense after you, maybe you want to open up the show notes and look at the diagram as Max explained it, because he explained it really well. And if I didn't have a diagram, I would have been falling asleep. So, but he did a really good job. So, well, more on that. I think that'll be a technology we'll follow more and more in 2017. And maybe we should try to get somebody from the ONL on the show to talk about it. So if any of our listeners out there know about the ONL at Pax River, let us know so we can get a hold of them and maybe get them on the show.
That'd be great.
So let's talk about delivery. And when you say the word delivery, there's a code word that says Amazon. And this is from CNBC. Amazon gets U.S. patent for, quote, countermeasures, unquote, to protect drone delivery. Yeah, I have this vision of a Amazon drone, Max, flying along, popping flares and chafe as it goes chugging along the street to deliver its package.
Yeah, no.
I mean, that was my first image when this came. But we're really not talking about this, but we are talking about protecting a network, hacking, would you agree?
Yeah. This technology patent has really two bases that it's built upon. One is a mesh network where you have a group of drones that are operating together. And in addition to that, you have some kind of communication that might even be encrypted between these drones, and they each kind of watch out for each other and detect the presence of possible signs of a compromised drone.
Well, and that makes sense because you're going to have traffic. If we are going to set up highways in the sky for drones going to and from these delivery centers, they're going to have to pass each other and meet each other, and you're going to want them to be on separate altitudes or separate, you know. So I guess we could say that it really isn't countermeasures and so much as an enhancement of the flow of traffic.
The problems that any one particular drone might encounter while it's making a delivery could be hacking, could be someone with malicious intent trying to interfere with a drone. But I could imagine there could be other events or other conditions that could impact the safety or the mission of the drone. I don't know what. That could be weather, sudden weather conditions, or some other interference or loss of signal or something. And I don't know if Amazon has it in mind to work in this way, but I could imagine that this could be used in those situations where there's a, you know, a detection process through this mesh network of drones, where if some condition like that does arise, that it's detected. Because the alternative is, you know, I don't know what, you know, the delivery fails, the drone fails, or something of that sort, and that's not a good solution. So, yeah, this is interesting stuff. It's Amazon is, I guess, thinking about this holistically and not just strictly the logistics of drone delivery or the technology of specifically drone delivery, but sort of the entire
practicality.
Package.
This is one of those things where we're talking practicality. You know, if you are going to do this, you have to start looking three or four steps down the road. And what is it that we need to do to make this practical? You know, not only do we have to invent a device that can do it, we need to develop the network. And so, like you said, it's a holistic view point. So, and like we've always said on Airplane Geeks, just because you get a patent doesn't mean it actually is going to actually appear for anything. So let's talk a little bit more about Amazon's goal, which is beyond line of sight. And this is from our friend Leah Reich at Precision Hawk. Precision Hawk research outlines operations risks for drones flying beyond line of sight. They are part of the FAA's UAS Pathfinder program, and they're moving on to step two or phase two. And it's beyond visual line of sight and setting up operations. And the FAA is using this as a way to set regulations, because we know that's a goal for 2017 is rules for beyond visual line of sight.
And you all probably recall that this Pathfinder program is a great idea. It's one where there are research partnerships that are created with industry in the FAA, looking at what do we need to consider when it comes to allowing UAS to fly in the national airspace system. So under this phase two research, Precision Hawk found that there really needs to be some technology assistance when it comes to beyond visual line of sight operations. What they did, I thought was fairly interesting, is they pulled together a large number of drone pilots and non-pilots, and they set up a series of scenarios where they had to make decisions while flying a drone beyond line of sight. And they being Precision Hawk, introduced a manned aircraft, an intruder aircraft, into the airspace. And the participants had to react to that, take a series of actions, in some cases to avoid potential collisions. And the researchers noted what the human operators did or didn't do and how successful they were or were not. And what they found was that, well, the humans might be pretty good, but they're not good enough. And that in order to safely operate beyond visual line of sight, there needs to be some technology assist available to the humans, which you could say, David, maybe that's not surprising, but at least what's happened here is that Precision Hawk has defined the baseline, sort of the human performance level baseline, that can then be used to evaluate technological assistance, which of course still has to be developed.
You know, and I, thinking about beyond visual line of sight, I've always wondered how delay, and when I was at Langley, this was one of the things that came up about anti-collision is, if you're flying line of sight, you know, we do fly at the speed of light, but there is a delay, especially if you're flying an aircraft a couple of miles or hundreds of miles away from your signal. So, you know, I've always wondered about drone operators, you know, flying Predators from Creech Air Force Base in Nevada. How much delay do they have from when they put the input in to quickly bank the aircraft to avoid a collision to how quickly that aircraft banks to avoid that collision, you know, and noticing. So this is going to be a huge challenge for beyond line of sight is going to be that delay and reaction time. You know, it's now you're adding a human in and their time to react is going to add some additional time to the reaction. So it's interesting. Like you said, it's really good that they've set up a baseline. This is what we assume people will do based on our experience. And now how do we improve that? How do we tweak it and get it so that it's a safer operation?
And you mentioned things like human reaction time. And Precision Hawk looked at other factors, other sort of human factors, such things as what were the lighting conditions? What was the light like at the time? What was the weather like? Things like from which direction did the intruder come? At them, across from them, things like that. Differences in the hearing abilities of some of the pilots, their visual acuity and things like that. So there's a lot of interesting factors that they considered. Also some more maybe qualitative factors, things like stress and boredom and even fatigue were also examined as part of this phase two study. So very, very fascinating. There's a phase three coming up, I think within a few months, and we'll certainly be watching for that. But I think all of this is really important to successfully get us to a place where beyond visual line of sight becomes practical, safe, you know, and economically feasible.
I'm taking a pause here because I don't know how to start this. Do you remember in early December of 2015, the FAA said, by Christmas, they would have a drone registration system set up, and we laughed.
We didn't really believe that it could be possible.
We didn't think that bureaucracy could actually magically appear. And
they proved us wrong.
Here we are a year later, and the FAA has still an active registration system, which, as a reminder, you get a new drone, don't forget to register it, but it's been fairly successful, and I think everyone would agree that the FAA did a good job with it.
Yeah, the FAA in their press release says that more than 600,000 owners have registered in the web-based drone registration system. There's some quotes from the press release. They say, the FAA says, the rule and registration system were primarily aimed at the thousands of drone hobbyists who had little or no experience with the U.S. aviation system. The agency saw registration as an excellent way to give them a sense of responsibility and accountability for their actions. The agency wanted them to feel they are part of the aviation community, to see themselves as pilots, which is kind of an interesting motivation. They do say that they've used the system to send out some safety messages to everyone who registered. I would also be curious to hear if there were any instances where they used the registration information, let's say in the case of somebody who was operating a drone unsafely, because that was part of the motivation that I remember anyway at the beginning of all this, is that, you know, with registrations, it would help identify certain people who were doing things they shouldn't do with drones. And I don't know if that happened or not.
I don't think so. And I come to think of it, did you ever get any notifications?
Well, I was trying to think of that when I
since we are both registered, it was sort of like, I don't know if I ever remember if I did. Oh, God forbid, it might have ended up in the spam box.
I cannot recall any myself, but it might be worth just doing a little search in my mail system to see if anything from the FAA comes up. But anyway, it's been 12 months, 600,000 owners registered, more than. There's a video that the FAA produced, 1 year anniversary of FAA's drone registry is the title of it. And we'll put a link to that in the show notes. You can actually watch it right from the show notes over at the uavdigest.com/176. So you can watch for that video there. But boy, do we have a bunch of videos of the week.
Yeah, that was a good segue. So after you watch the FAA video, because it actually is pretty good, we've got 6 innovative drone videos of 2016. Yes, we're doing another list, but this is pretty good. Starting off with the 6 drone videos are an aerial perspective of Nordland, a really depressing one called The Destruction of Aleppo, construction of the Apple Campus 2, and we sort of get that video on a regular basis from our pseudo co-host Max Trescott as he flies over that on a regular basis. Tight Squeeze, a Ford commercial. And I think we are friends, but I'm not going to say it, but that Ford commercial I think was done by one of our really good friends to this show. A single shot approach and a top down approach. So that's 6 videos that you can watch. And of course, the links are in the show notes. And of course, what would be the end of the year without a Christmas video? What do you think, Max?
Yeah, this is this is kind of amazing. This is I would call it a super heavy lift multi-rotor. Some guys built this drone.
You can say that again?
A super heavy lift multi-rotor. This is a monster. This is a monster. Well, how powerful is this thing? Well, I can't tell you other than to say that it's strong enough to lift a human being up in the air. So this was filmed in Finland in the snow, and there's some drone boarding involved and also some aerial gymnastics, I'll call it, with one of the guys in this big drone. It's really gone viral. As we record this, it's only been out on YouTube for 2 days, and it's already got 6 million views. So it's pretty interesting, and yeah, it does have a little bit of a Christmassy flavor to it. There's also a behind-the-scenes video that's also offered up, which I haven't watched the entire thing. It's long. It's 15 minutes, but it gives you kind of a peek behind the curtain and some more information about the drone and stuff. But
I scanned it. It's pretty good.
It is.
It definitely, you have to watch both. I mean, because if you're like me, the how do they do it always catches my attention. So it's really good. And it's a nice way to end the video of the week and for the year. What do you think, Max?
It is. And it's sort of a little bit festive. And it's, you know, it's the kind of thing where I'm kind of glad somebody figured out how to put together a machine that's this powerful, but it's probably going to influence other people to try some stunts that maybe they shouldn't. Yeah.
So don't do this at home.
Don't do this at home. This is kind of like, in some ways, you know, the guy with the lawn chair and the 100 helium balloons, you know, flying up in the air and interfering with other aircraft. It's kind of interesting to look at, but not so
don't
smart
try
to
this
do
it. At home.
No. So, all right. Well, I think that's about it. That's this episode. We want to thank you all for listening, not only to this episode, but also to the UAV Digest in 2016. We really, really appreciate it. We hope you'll take a look at the show notes over at the UAVDigest.com/176. Have a lot of links to the articles, to the videos. Maybe since we're not going to have an episode next week, you'll have more time to spend watching some of those videos. But we hope you enjoy those.
I think we should also thank our sponsors, Max, for another great year for 2016. We're looking forward to growing the show a little bit more in 2017, we hope. I'd like to thank my co-host for everything he does for the show. I got the easy work. I just find the articles. He does all the hard work, heavy lifting.
No, that's not true.
And we'd like to, of course, thank Drone Mama for all she does. It's a fun show. I know both Max and I look forward to doing it every week, and we look forward to the way we interact with all of you, either via Twitter, at our Twitter account, which is UAV Digest, or on Facebook, or, of course, on our Slack listener team, which we'd love for you to join. Start us with 2017. Send us an email. We'll send you a link. And the nice thing about it is it's just people like you who have interests. So it's a really enjoyable group, a lot of fun, a lot of interesting stuff pops up that we don't get a chance to talk to. Some of them we drag into the show notes and the show, but a lot of other stuff as the week goes on, there's a lot of stuff you can pick up on. And of course, we'd love for you to leave feedback, and you can leave feedback at MTV. Listen to me. Oh, it's getting, boy. Feedback on Google Play or Stitcher or, of course, iTunes. Wow, I'm the Apple user and I can't remember iTunes. But we really enjoy doing this. We're looking forward to 2017, and hopefully you'll join us next year. So I guess with that, I'll say Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, and Happy New Year. This is David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thank you for listening.